Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. I have a tiny little thing that I want to point out.
I'm sorry to hear that.
You are so sophomoric, I can't even stand it. Bon Appetit magazine came out with a great issue, and they came out with the best ice cream shops, the top 10 ice cream shops in the country. I don't know that I agree with them all, but you know, it's nice to have. These things are really useful in that they're a good guide for great ice cream shops to go and hit, and we're just the kind of guys to chase those leads down, aren't we? But here was the thing that I thought was interesting and made this whole thing worthy of mention. They talked about one in Scottsdale, Arizona, one in San Francisco, one in Los Angeles, Atlanta. The one in New York that they picked for their best ice cream shop is the Van Leeuwen Artisan Ice Cream Trucks. Never heard of them. And the description is, these retrofitted postal service vehicles purvey high-quality 18% butterfat formulas, and the vanilla is made with organic beans aged in vodka. Must-try flavor is vanilla. Locations change. Obviously, it's a truck.
It's a truck.
There
cool.
are several of them. But the phone number is 718-701-1630, or you can go to vanleeuwenicecream.com. We'll put that up on our site, VanLeeuwen. ICECREAM.com and find out where the trucks are.
Why do I get this picture of you and me in a cab going, follow that truck! Follow that truck! Don't let them out of your sight!
I think that's because that's likely is why I think you find that to be. But what a 21st century thing. I remember the name of my first ice cream man in Orange, New Jersey.
Really?
Nate. Nate was the ice cream man. He was a good humor man who came around the Orange and South Orange route.
You know when you got a problem?
I was destined to be in the food business.
When you memorized the name of the ice cream man.
He was my buddy. So you want to know what's funny?
Exactly my point.
We moved to Orange when I...
He was my buddy.
We moved out of Orange when I was in grammar school, right? And Orange is a city. It's a challenged city here in New Jersey, and nothing good has happened to Orange since I left. There's a great pizza there. There's some great people there, and I wish it well, but it was time to go. So my parents moved to a suburb because Orange was getting a little violent, actually. And so we really regretfully moved out of Orange. I've been there, you know, for generations. Mm-hmm. Off the boat from Ireland to Orange, and then we moved to Livingston. And I remember that, and my mother reminded me of this, and I remember that when we moved to Livingston, the ice cream man's name was Frank. So I know his name, too. And I remember...
I am very disturbed right now, I have to tell you.
Here's why I heard it. I asked Frank, and I was very lonely for Orange. I really missed Orange. Orange was a bit more of a city, had a lot of family there, a lot of history there. We moved to a suburb on a cul-de-sac and a house that looked like everybody else's house, just painted a different color. And the ice cream man came, and my mom bought me an ice cream. And I remember I said to the ice cream man, I said, well, what's your name? And he said, I'm Frank. I said, oh... Well, Nate's my ice cream man. He's the ice cream man from Orange. Do you know Nate? He's like, oh, yeah, me and Nate are good friends. It was only years later that my mother told me, Frank didn't really know Nate. He didn't know Nate at all.
We didn't really take the dog out to pasture, Francis. He didn't really go to the farm.
Frank didn't know Nate at all, that son of a bitch. No. But I became friends with Frank, and everything went on great. So I acclimated to Livingston, and now I'm in Metuchen. And I don't know the name of my current ice cream man. That should give you just a little bit of solace.
That means you're doing it wrong, I guess.
We'll be back with a much more serious topic. We're going to be talking with Benjamin Wallace about his wonderful book, The Billionaire's Vinegar, The Mystery of the World's Most Expensive Bottle of Wine. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in lovely downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Benjamin Wallace. His work has appeared in GQ, Food and Wine, Salon, The Washington Post, Details, etc. But his current book is called The Billionaire's Vinegar, The Mystery of the World's Most Expensive Bottle of Wine.
Hey, Ben, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
This is pretty darn interesting work here, The Billionaire's Vinegar. This is about the Thomas Jefferson bottle of wine that was sold at auction, the most expensive bottle of wine in the world. Turns out that it in all probability, was a fraud, yes?
That is correct. And it, also, I should mention that not only was it the most expensive bottle when it sold in 1985, but even now in 2009, it remains the record price for a single bottle of wine.
And it was a fraud. So I'd imagine the person who bought it is pretty unhappy about that, being a fraud.
I mean, the Forbes family bought this bottle in 1985, and a week before the auction, Monticello, which, you know, was where Thomas Jefferson lived and which is now a center of Jefferson scholarship, they had already gone public in the New York Times with their doubts about this bottle, which had supposedly belonged to Thomas Jefferson. So the Forbes has had some reason to know there might be questions about the bottle even before they bought it.
So why did
they're happy to learn that it likely is a fraud? No, but I'm not sure how upset they are.
So why did they go ahead and buy it if they thought that it was possibly a fraud?
Well, I don't know if they you know, really paid attention to it. I mean, at the time Malcolm Forbes was alive, he was a guy to make a splash. He, you know, everything to him was kind of fun and publicity. And buying a bottle of Thomas Jefferson's wine was certainly fun, and he got a huge amount of publicity for setting this price record. And the Forbeses, in addition to collecting wine, were collectors of presidential memorabilia, so the bottle appealed to those levels.
He's still getting publicity for it, apparently.
Yes, I mean, it's a gift that keeps on giving. Every few years, these bottles have made the news for one reason or another. I mean, it's not just this bottle, but other bottles that were found with it that supposedly also had belonged to Jefferson. And every few years, you know, doubts have been raised about them and made them enter the news once again.
Ben, I think a lot of people thought when this book first came out a little while ago that it was going to be a book for wine geeks, and it was that kind of a book about, you know, wine and where it comes from and counterfeiting wine. But it really became a lot more than that, didn't it?
It did, and that was really my idea for the book in the first place, because I am not a wine geek, and instead I'm just a, you know, journalist. It's a good story. I like wine. I'm interested in food. But the whole genesis of the book was that I, you know, wished there was wine books out there that were just kind of accidentally books that were first and foremost, you know, a great story. And so there really weren't that many books like that. And so I set about finding a story like that I could write about for my first book.
I will tell you, as a guy who reads a lot of wine books, some of the historical references for the wine world and Napa and Sonoma and places like that especially are really dry. Really informative, but really dry.
Well, the thing is that what's interesting about the book, before we talk more about the book, tell our audience how this was attributed to Thomas Jefferson. What was the story that was perpetrated or the alleged provenance of the bottle?
Okay, well, in 1985, this German guy named Hardy Rodenstock, who was a top band manager turned wine dealer, announced to his friends in the wine world that he had, you know, made this incredible discovery in Paris. Supposedly, some workmen doing construction on a building in Paris with foundations dating to the 1750s had broken through a brick wall and stumbled upon this hidden cache of wine. And miraculously, you know, these bottles had really high fill levels, and they had the name of the chateau engraved in them and the vintage engraved in them, and even better, the initial THJ engraved in them. And so it soon emerged that, you know, these could only be the initials of Thomas Jefferson, who had in fact lived in Paris from 1784 to 1789, and these bottles were 1787 and 1784 vintages.
Which are vintages that he had actually purchased.
1784, yes, 1787, no, which was one of the reasons why Monticello was skeptical from the beginning. And he had bought certain of these chateaux, but not all of them. And the chateau included Lafitte and Margaux and Yquem and Mouton. And so Rodenstock announced that he had made this discovery, and then Michael Broadbent, head auctioneer at Christie's in London, thought this would be a really great feather in his cap to auction off one of these bottles.
Now, was it common at the time for Chateau Lafite to engrave the bottles with not only the vintage and the chateau name, but the initials of the buyer?
No.
So
that said, Jefferson had, there were a few instances where Jefferson, in letters, noted that he had asked for bottles to be engraved, but when he asked for them to be engraved, it was just with a single initial of himself or John Jay or George Washington, who he was also ordering wine for.
Huh. So take us through the mystery. Now, there's some questions about the provenance of the bottle. Now, there are many of these bottles, and they're out there, and they're very expensive bottles of wine. Tell us what really happened, what you think really happened.
Okay. Well, so from the beginning, you know, Rodenstock was incredibly vague about where this building in Paris was and, you know, who had owned the building and how many bottles there were. And because he would never clarify the picture, you know, people just became more and more suspicious. And eventually, a guy who bought four of these bottles, Bill Koch, launched a full-fledged investigation, spending over $1 million. He used former FBI agents, former MI5 agents, former Scotland Yard agents, and they kind of fanned over the globe and interviewed, you know, a lot of people who knew Rodenstock, and they uncovered quite a bit. And basically, I mean, there's still a lot of unknowns, but the circumstantial evidence would suggest that these bottles did not belong to Thomas Jefferson. There's a fair amount of evidence that the wine in at least some of the bottles was put in the bottles post-1950, and there's evidence that the engravings of the bottles were done with a modern power tool.
And didn't they find in one of this guy's apartments when he moved out basically a little laboratory where he could have easily produced these old-looking bottles?
Yes, his landlord went into his, I think it was a sort of half of a house that Rodenstock was renting in Munich, and found in the basement there were two rooms, and in one were the materials for what seemed to be a old wine forging laboratory, blank labels, blank old bottles. And in the other room, there was an enormous pile of dirt. And for some reason, it seemed it had a dead frog in it, which no one's ever explained to me. But the landlord's theory was that he was, you know, making these bottles in one room and making them look old in the other.
And dirtying them in another room.
That's great.
Very nice. As you go through this book, you know, Rodenstock's story gets a little shadier and shadier and shadier. I think even his name gets a little shadier as you go through the book.
Yeah, so tell us about what happened, where we are now with what we think of Rodenstock, or what's been discovered, and, you know, where he is in the wine world now. Has it been universally accepted that these wines are not of that provenance, and has he ever paid a price for it?
Well, I mean, I would say he has paid a price in that, you know, his name is pretty much dirt in the wine world. I mean, I don't think anyone who knows anything about wine would buy wine from the guy. You know, there has not been a legal judgment of his guilt. There's a pending civil suit by Bill Koch against Rodenstock. It looks like Koch will win a default judgment because Rodenstock has basically stopped defending the lawsuit. And at that point, you know, Koch will face the challenge of trying to collect assets from Rodenstock, who I think will be, you know, pretty protected in Europe.
Maybe he can get some real cool Thomas Jefferson bottles from him.
He can pay him in old bottles of wine.
Old or new, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, Michael Broadbent, who auctioned off the bottle, continues to believe that the bottles are authentic. So he is someone who has not, to my mind, accepted the overwhelming evidence that they're not.
Well, isn't that partially, you think, because because he vouched for the provenance of them in the beginning, that if he admits now that the bottles weren't legit, that
there's a liability issue.
His own judgment is called into question.
I think that's right, because, you know, this bottle in some ways was, you know, the most famous bottle he ever auctioned off. And not only did he vouch for this bottle, but he subsequently sold two other Jefferson bottles from the cash, one to Marvin Schenken, the owner of Wine Spectator magazine, and he also vouched for Rodenstock. I mean, he's included over 1,000 tasting notes in his big book of tasting notes came from bottles that came from Rodenstock.
So, Ben, how did you get turned on to this story? How did this all start for you?
Well, you know, back in 2000, I was working as a magazine writer in Philadelphia, and I wanted to know more about wine, and I found myself browsing in these wine sections in bookstores, and as you mentioned, you know, some of these references are pretty dry, like the history of soil composition in the Loire Valley, and I had always been a big fan of narrative nonfiction, like, you know, Seabiscuit or The Perfect Storm or Devil in the White City, where you're just reading this great story, and at the end of it, you realize that you've learned a ton about some nonfiction subject. And so I, you know, thought wine would lend itself to a book like that. I then thought, well, maybe I could do a biography of a single bottle of wine, but that could be really boring if the bottle, you know, isn't extremely unusual. And so I was then reading Jancis Robinson, the British wine writer's memoir of her professional career, and she intersected with a few of these Jefferson bottles. And so that's how I first learned about it. And it just sounded like from the combination of these larger-than-life characters who intersected with the bottles and the mystery and the Jefferson connection, there were just a lot of elements that I thought would lend themselves to an interesting book.
You know, I love Seabiscuit, and I love The Perfect Storm. I thought they were terrific, and I agree with what you say about them. But if someone had suggested to me that that wine would be a good, and I know a lot about wine, that's what we do for a living, that wine would be a good arena in which to do the same thing, I would not have thought it was a good idea. And that's just a testament to what a great writer you are, because it's a fascinating book. You can't put it down.
Well, and, thank you very much. But, you know, I would say another parallel book would be Searching for Bobby Fischer. I mean, I don't think anyone would say, it'd be easy to write a page-turner about chess, but Fred Waitzkin, who wrote that book, succeeded. And I think what's more important than, you know, the world it's taking place in is the characters and the plot or mystery, if there is one.
Well, and you know, I have to say, I'm looking at the paperback of your book right now, and I've just noticed for the first time, this certainly has a highbrow appeal, but there's a little medallion on mine that says, as a quote from USA Today, "Splendid, a delicious mystery." So that's, you know, very common man review of this book, saying, you know, it's take it to the beach if you want, and I agree completely.
Yeah, no, I was very happy, you know, to get reviews like that, because the idea from the beginning was I wanted the book to be credible, you know, within the wine world, but I mainly wanted it to appeal to people who weren't in the wine world and who could learn through the book how potentially fascinating wine actually can be.
Well, Ben, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about two things. I hear rumors of a movie being made about the book, and I also want to talk about some things you learned about wine counterfeiting in general, and we can have a little discussion about what's going on today with some other wines that may be counterfeit. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Benjamin Wallace about his book, The Billionaire's Vinegar. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. You know, if you're looking for a perfect restaurant or a home-cooked meal in the Garden State, look no further than Dining Out Magazine, New Jersey. Dining Out's the premier dining guide for northern and central Jersey. It provides the right information to help you make your dining decisions. Whether you're looking for a romantic dinner, a power lunch, entertaining a large group, finding the perfect caterer, or just a night out on the town, Dining Out provides a sample menu, beautiful pictures and reviews, and over 100 of the best restaurants in the state are included. Of course, Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left among them. Dining Out Magazine and DiningOut.com are the go-to dining resource for the Garden State. Aside from comprehensive restaurant listings section, you'll also find in every issue recipes from your favorite chefs, profiles, interviews, and features on dining trends, both in the state and around the country. The latest edition explores the hidden treasures of rural Italy, the finest Italian foods made only by hand, a do-it-yourself journal of wine, beer, and cheese, and unique cocktails from seasoned bartenders throughout the Garden State. Not to mention a list of upcoming events, classes, and charity events hand-picked by Dining Out's senior editors. You can pick up your copy today at Barnes & Noble, Borders, Whole Foods, or visit them at www.diningout.com to view all the restaurants listed and join their subscription list. Dining Out is the ultimate must-have resource to feed the inner foodie in you. That's at diningout.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking today with Benjamin Wallace about his book, The Billionaire's Vinegar, The Mystery of the World's Most Expensive Bottle of Wine. I have read that there's possible movie deals in the works here for your book.
That's true. The film rights have been optioned by a group of producers, including the actor Will Smith. And they have attached a writer-director, David Koepp, who has written a number of well-known movies, including Jurassic Park, and also directed the movie Ghost Town, which came out last year.
I cannot wait until I see the movie and I see how they work in spaceships, dinosaurs, and a car crash.
I do think it was really interesting the way you tied in kind of the modern day mystery and the story of what's going on with this bottle of wine with the Jefferson history of how it might have come about or probably didn't come about.
Right. I mean, I definitely wanted to include the story of Jefferson as a wine connoisseur because he truly was, you know, in his day, the greatest wine connoisseur around. And even today in Bordeaux, some of these chateaux, their only records of what their wines tasted like in the 18th century come from Jefferson's notes.
He was amazing. And, you know, he also believed very strongly, because America at the time, we were drinking distilled spirits. We were drinking whiskey. And he felt that it was good for, would be good for the national character if we would drink wine. And we didn't.
That would have a sort of civilizing influence.
I mean, yeah.
People, you know, would be more moderate if they just enjoyed wine as kind of part of an intimate life and, you know, enjoying it at the table rather than getting on whiskey.
Yeah, unfortunately, he lived in Virginia instead of California, so his vineyard didn't do as well as it might have.
Yeah. Well, let's, you know, I want to talk about what you may have learned about wine counterfeiting today. I have friends who work in Las Vegas, and my one friend said, yeah, there were more bottles of 1961 Chateau Latour served in Las Vegas last year than were ever made. It's miraculous. Because
you hear that about a lot of the sort of, you know, really cult vintages and cult wines. I mean, the 1947 Cheval Blanc in particular, I think a lot of people regard as the most faked wine in the world. I mean, there's really a question of how much of the actual stuff still exists.
So what do we learn about counterfeiting? What is the state of counterfeiting today in wine?
Well, I think the first important thing to note is just most people don't really need to even think about this, because, you know, it really, in general, is not going to apply to the wines that most of us drink most of the time.
Right. There's no point in counterfeiting a $20 or $40 or $50 bottle of wine.
Or even a $200 bottle of wine. There's no point in doing it.
Exactly. I mean, the incentive is to do it with these extremely rare bottles. So only if you're kind of playing that really rare wine game is this, you know, going to affect your pocketbook or what you're drinking. And therefore, these statistics are kind of misleading and vague, and we don't know what we don't know. But certainly, you know, for instance, the 1947 Cheval Blanc, I think Serena Sutquist, the head auctioneer at Sotheby's, who's been a canary in the coal mine about counterfeiting, I think she would say, you know, it's as likely as not that a bottle of that is going to be fake.
Right, sure.
You know, and that applies probably to other extremely rare or expensive or coveted wines like 1982, you know, Petrus or Le Pen, which has a very small production. Especially then when you get into these older, you know, 1900 Margaux or 1928 Petrus in a Magnum or Jeroboam, there's some real question whether Petrus was ever bottled back then in large formats, and yet, you know, large format bottles of Petrus from the 20s have been turning up for years, many at Rodenstock tasting.
And that's funny. And that's how a lot of these are found out. So something's done with the wine that wasn't done at that time, for instance, putting it in Magnums when it was not put in Magnums at that time.
Yes, but one of the tricky things with this is that at the same time, Petrus wasn't keeping a lot of records in the 1920s. So someone could say, well, how do you know that the winemaker didn't make a couple Magnums for a friend? And the truth is that it is possible they could have, because a certain amount of things take place off the books at wineries, and there wouldn't necessarily be a record of them happening. That said, it's unlikely that they did, but a guy like Rodenstock can hide behind that narrow margin of wiggle room and say, you know, how can you refute?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that's interesting is how modern winemaking wineries do have great record keeping, and we know exactly how things are put into bottles, and it's easier to spot in contemporary winemaking. There are steps that a winemaker can take that allow you to fingerprint the wine and make sure it's more legit. But when you're talking about older wines, I remember, Mark, we bought some wines from the early 60s we bought some port from the early 60s.
1970 grams is what it was, or 63 grams maybe.
63 is what it was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, port, it came in and we had been buying 63 grams, and we got in some bottles that they looked different than the other bottles. And they tasted a little different than the other bottles we had. And that is a fairly expensive, a few hundred dollars a bottle, and we were buying it cases at a time for the restaurants. And we thought we had a counterfeit, but it turns out in our research that we didn't have a counterfeit, that it was the custom in that time for some houses to ship port back in cask to England and then bottle it in England. So some of that port was bottled in Portugal, and some of it was bottled in different bottles in England, and they were both legit.
Exactly, and it was also customary for the middlemen doing the bottling to sometimes, you know, doctor the wine or the port a little bit, any sort of, you know, malevolent or ill-intentioned way, but just, you know, to sort of modify it for what they thought their customers would enjoy. That was just part of the business.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. The book is wonderful, Ben. Good luck on the movie, and thanks for coming on our show.
Thank you guys very much.
Thanks, Ben.
The book is Billionaire's Vinegar. You can pick it up through our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and find out more about it. It's a total page-turner for the summer. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com. I would like to announce the most exciting new project Mark and I have launched in years. We've teamed up with some old friends, Mike and Jennifer Schnurr, and worked with our chefs and purveyors of artisanal food products to create RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Yeah, baby, we've created a line of extraordinary and delicious chocolates in a palette of thoughtful and complex flavors. They're sexy, they come in a great, beautiful red box, they're handmade, and they make a perfect gift or a perfect personal indulgence. We ship overnight, or you can pick them up at the restaurants. The website is restaurantguyschocolate.com, or find the link at restaurantguysradio.com. We put our heart and soul into every box, and each one's made by hand. There's a little bit of my soul in every piece of candy, that's right, and a little bit of Mark's too. So check out restaurantguyschocolate.com. Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left, and Catherine Lombardi. I thought the book was great. Could have been very dry, was fun, was a page-turner, and he's a smart dude.
Yeah, he really took a topic, and we talked about this earlier in the show, that could have been, you know, one of the worst reads ever as far as, you know, just, counterfeit bottle came about. But he really delved into the story. He got the backstories of all these very interesting people who are involved in this world. And he tied in the Jefferson history, again, without making it dry.
Yeah, it was fun.
It was really interesting to kind of jump back and forth in time.
You know, when they make it into a movie, I'm hoping they make it into a musical.
I don't think they're going to make it into a musical.
I think that would be tough, don't you? Although I go see it. One of the things I talked about was modern winemaking's methods for ensuring the provenance of bottles. Chateau Petrus, the cult winemaker in Pomerol, they started printing labels with codes that are visible only under ultraviolet light. Chateau Yquem has started using stronger glue for its labels. Margaux in the Medoc uses a laser to etch a serial code into the neck of each bottle. You know, the problem is, in 100 years, your 9-year-old's going to have a laser etcher in their pen.
And exactly what I was just about to say. The better we get at trying to stop counterfeiting from happening, the better the counterfeiters will get at deciphering what they need to do to make it happen. Here's
one, though, that I think is going to be tough. You ready?
Go ahead.
Bottles, labels, and corks with botanical DNA to match the wine. There's a good one.
And so we'll create DNA. You know, 50 years from now, we'll be creating botanical DNA.
That's a pretty high bar, though, I have to tell you.
Well, you know, here's the problem, the way I see it. Here's the problem with this whole thing. We've created these collectibles. And when we treat wine as a collectible, we have to realize that just like having Honus Wagner's baseball rookie card has become big business, and it's big business to forge that baseball card. It's big business to forge some of these wines as collectibles. And, you know, you've heard Francis and I talk about this before. Stop collecting wine.
Yeah, drink it.
It's not about having a wine collection. It's about having a wine cellar so you can enjoy the things that are in your cellar, not just have these trophies.
I agree. The thing about it is, you know, a baseball card is created as a collectible, and for it to exist as a collectible, it has no other purpose. That's great. But for a bottle of wine not to have been drunk
is a waste.
It's sad. It's sad. And I just have no interest in collecting wines. I have no interest in trying to gain status from having great wines. I have an interest in drinking great wines. I like talking about wines with people who are actually interested in getting enjoyment out of drinking the wines. All too often, I talk with people who are interested in establishing their status by telling me the great wines in their cellar. And my rule is, if I have to listen to you talk about it, you better be popping a cork and we better be drinking some. Okay, that's when I'm interested. Okay, or there better be the prospect of that in the very near future, or I'm bored. Okay. Anyway, I hope that you enjoyed our little hour here with the Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I am Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.